And your name is?
Vojtech Nika.
Vojtech Nika.
Yes, should I say it again?
Please, it's okay.
I'll say it again at the start of the presentation.
Okay.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Vojtech Nikl, and I would like to give you a short presentation about parallelism in modern compilers. So, let me start with a short introduction. What is parallelism when we are talking about computer science? Basically, this picture says that we have four basic levels of parallelism: task level parallelism, control level parallelism, data level parallelism, and instruction level parallelism. The more up the level we are, the larger grain or larger code grain we use. So at the bottom we can see instruction level parallelism is very fine grain. It is implemented in hardware and it is not programmable by a programmer. It is basically only a hardware optimization. The second level is data level parallelism. In this presentation, I will focus mainly on this level. Next is control level parallelism, which is more coarser grain parallelism. You can see that in a single task, we can run multiple, for example, multiple functions in parallel. And the highest level of parallelism is task parallelism, for example, on distributed systems like clusters or supercomputers. So, on the next slides, I will very briefly say more details about the levels of parallelism. So, instruction level parallelism, as I said, is implemented in hardware. Every instruction has four basic steps. When we process the instruction, it is instruction fetch, instruction decode, execute, and writing back the results into the memory. In this example, on the x-axis we have time in cycles, and on the y-axis we have processed instructions. So in this example, we can process two instructions in a one time cycle, and basically the parallelism is applied in the way that we use pipelines, which is this red part, and we can do these four steps in parallel. So in one pipeline we can do multiple steps at once, and this can increase the performance of computation. The next level, more coarser grained level, is data level parallelism. Basically, the main example of data level parallelism is vectorization. Imagine this example. We have four vectors, including the resulting one. We have B vector, C vector, and D vector. And we want to add vector B, vector C, and we want to multiply it by vector D. If we have scalar version, it computes the process only by a single element. So if the vector is 8 elements long, we have to do this operation 8 times in a cycle or in a loop. But if we use vectorization, we can do this operation on vector in a single time step. Basically, the vectorization uses long CPU registers, and the theoretical performance gain of this approach can be up to 8. It is not that simple in practice, but in theory it should work this way. The third level is control level parallelism, also called threading. Basically, we have we can run different tasks in parallel. We start with a master thread, and for example, on the last slide, we did operation on 4 vectors, and if, for example, we would like to do this operation on many more or multiple vectors, we can do one addition in task in parallel task 1, one addition in parallel task in the second parallel task, and a third addition in the third parallel task. This is control level parallelism is applied on multi-core systems, and basically on multi-core systems, and each of these tasks can run on a single core. And the last one is message passing or task level parallelism. The main example here is message passing interface. This is what I mainly specialize in. It is basically connecting multiple computers together and computing a single task in parallel using these computers. These computers are connected in a network, and they communicate using messages. Okay, that's a simple summarization of how parallelism works. And now let's move to, now we know what is parallelism and how do we enhance it and how do we use it correctly. So the main motivation is compilers do parallelization based on 2 ideas, reordering statements and executing them in parallel. Well, but this is not so easy task, because we want to do this without changing the semantics of the program. Okay, but what is the main problem here? The main problem when we want to parallelize serial code is data dependencies. And I will mainly focus on this problem and how can we solve it. Okay, what is data dependence? Imagine we have a program with 2 statements, A and B, and we say B depends on A if B follows A roughly. It doesn't have to be immediately after A, but only roughly following the A. They share the same memory location. It means they access the same memory cells, let's say, and one of them writes to it. This is important because if 2 statements only read, there is no problem, and we can parallelize without any problems. It is written as B delta A, which means B depends on A. Here is a short example. We have 2 statements, A and B, and here is a problem that the statement B uses variable X, which is computed just before the statement B. So these 2 statements cannot be executed in parallel, and they cannot be reordered because there is a data dependency on the variable X. We have several types of dependencies. There is a simple classification. There are three main types of dependencies: true, anti-dependence, and output dependence. True means A writes to a location that B later reads. That's what was shown on the previous slide. The opposite is A reads a location that B later writes. And output dependence is both statements want to write to the same location. There could be also the fourth dependence, the fourth example, and that is when both want to read. But as I said before, if we want to read one variable by 2 statements, there is no problem when parallelizing that code. Next, what we have to define before we move on is iteration space. Simply said, iteration space is a space in memory where the data are stored and where the data dependence may occur. Here is a simple example. We have two nested loops. One is from 1 to 5 and the other one is from 1 to 6 index. And so this is the iteration space. And if we write it in lexicographic order, the iteration space is written like this. So basically we convert the 2D space into 1D space by storing the matrix by the order row. So we have the first row, then the second row, third row, and so on. And then it is equivalent to sequential execution order. Okay, now we have defined the iteration space, and now we also need to define the vector order so we can analyze the data dependence. Let's have a set of all real n vectors, r to the nth, and we define lexicographic order on these vectors. And it is a relation where if I is related to j on these two vectors, so if these two vectors are related, only if the first elements of the vectors are the same, and then the element indexed u is let's say lesser than or smaller. I'll explain what that means later on the examples. There are also some notes. The leading element of a vector is the first non-zero element. And a negative vector has leading element lesser than zero, and positive vector has leading element greater than zero. Okay, now let's move to distance and direction vectors. And this is important for analyzing the data dependence when we want to do vectorization. We have two vectors, I and j, and their distance vector is defined as this. We subtract each elements of the vector, and what it represents is it represents the number of iterations between accesses to the same location. So this is the distance vector, number of iterations between accesses to the same location, and the direction vector is computed very similar, but we only care about the sign. We don't care about the number, but we care only about the sign, if it's negative, positive, or zero, or neutral. And it represents the direction in the iteration space. So basically, it represents in which way in the iteration space the loop is iterating. Okay, so here's some example. It is often convenient to deal with incompletely specified direction vectors. What does it mean? Imagine we have these four vectors, and if we want to compute a direction vector, which is here, we go by the element. So on the first index, we have 0, 0, 0, 0. So the resulting direction, the first element of the resulting direction vector is 0. But on the second position, we have 0, minus 1, 0, minus 1. So it is more complex. So we write lesser than or equal 0. On the third position, we have zeros and plus 1s. So we write greater than 0. And on the fourth position, we have only 1s. So in the resulting direction vector, there is 1. In the second example, if we have multiple values, negative and positive, like minus 1, 0, and 1, we write a star in the direction vector. So let I and j denote two vectors in the vector space, and let s is their direction vector. Then then I is lesser than j if s has one of the following forms. So basically it has to start with one, and then it the rest is stars, as I mentioned before, or there has to be zeros before the one. So the only possible options are one in the vector, then zeros before and or in front of the one, and stars after the one. And we can use this simple notation that zero is equal, one is greater than, and minus one is lesser than. Okay, so now we can move to practical examples. When after we define the theory, there is a simple statement: it is valid to convert a sequential loop into a parallel loop if the loop carries no dependencies. And there is a simple proof of that, which has two main points. The first one is iteration reordering is fine if the loop carries no dependencies. That basically says that if the loop has five iterations, we can start with the second iteration, then do, for example, the fourth iteration, then the fifth iteration. It doesn't matter in which order we do it, because there are no dependencies. And dependence violation may occur due to interleaving of statements from different loop iterations. But dependencies at the level inside the loop cannot cause violation since they are executed sequentially. That means in a single loop, in one iteration of a single loop, there cannot be the parallelization cannot cause any violation of dependencies, because one iteration is executed sequentially, so it does not affect that. And dependencies at the level outside the parallelized loop are preserved. That means if we have a loop and we parallelize it, then we don't affect anything outside the loop. How does the loop parallelization work on modern compilers? Modern compilers and basically all programs today use so-called vectorization, as I mentioned at the start of the presentation. Vectorizing a loop is shown in this simple example. We have a simple for loop which adds two vectors, vector A and vector B, and stores the result in vector C. And we can do multiple elements at once using vectorization and vectorization unit, which has longer registers than the common unit. And in practice, how do we turn on vectorization? For example, in the Intel compiler, we can use the XSSA or XAVX parameters to use the SSA vectorization unit or the AVX vectorization unit. We can use F3 vectorize parameter to tell the compiler to try to vectorize using every vectorization unit possible. So we don't have to know if the system has AVX or SSC units. We can just call F3 vectorize. And if we want to see which loops were vectorized, we can use the vec report argument, and then it tells us which loops were successfully vectorized and which not, and why not. So we can adjust the code so the compiler can vectorize it. Okay, this is very similar to the previous statement. Loop can be directly vectorized if the statement is not included in any cycle of dependence. We have a very single algorithm that is not vectorized here. It is two nested for loops. And we have one vector, where we add element of vector with scalar and we store it to position a plus 1 and we take the element from the row index I. The distance or the direction vector is in this case is lesser than an equal because the a plus 1 is dependent on the a, so it is lesser than, and the j is the same on both sides, so it's equal. However, we can vectorize the loop as follows. We can vectorize the j loop, and basically we can say that we want to vectorize according to the column index, and this code is now vectorizable.
How many more pictures do you have?
I'm running out of time.
Almost.
I have, I think, 4 more pictures.
Okay.
The next approach how to enhance parallelism is loop interchange. It is very simple. Loop interchange switches the nesting order of two loops in a perfect loop nest. That basically means that we can enhance coarse grain parallelism by moving the inner loop to outer loop or switching the inner loop with outer loop. And we can also enhance the fine grain parallelism if we move outer loops to more inner loops. So what is perfect nest? Basically, we have a series of nested loops, and they don't have any data dependence in their parameters. So you can imagine this as if this is a for loop. This is the starting statement, ending statement, and is it called iterative statement? I'm not so sure now. And each of these four loops have different these statements, so they are not data dependent. And only the statements here inside the inner loop may be dependent, but when we talk about perfect nest, we care only about the parameters in the headers of the loops, and they are not dependent. They are always different in each loop. Okay, on this slide, it is saying that if we switch the nesting order of two loops, for example, here we start with the loop I, and then inside the loop I we do the loop j, then if we switch these loops, then the also the permutation of the direction vector switches the same way. So here we have equal and lesser than, and the direction vector switches to lesser than and equal. But even if we permute or switch these two loops, it is still not preventing data dependence, and intuitively we can say that the direction vector of an interchange preventing dependence has to be lesser than and greater than. And the last thing I would like to talk about is scalar expansion. Basically, scalar expansion is the replacement of a scalar by a temporary array. And unfortunately, scalar expansion is not free. It takes extra memory, additional memory accesses, and requires more complex addressing. And the main challenge when using this approach is determining profitable expansions by looking at the dependence graph, because not every scalar expansion is profitable for parallelism and for the overall performance. Here I have an example. This is a for loop where there is a scalar. There are two nested loops. Then we store 0 to a scalar value. Then we use it in a third loop. And how we can do the scalar expansion? We can say that the scalar is actually an array of size n. We can store zeros to every element of the array. And then if we use it like this as an array, then the code can be vectorized. This type of code cannot be vectorized by a vectorization unit, but here when we use an array, we can easily vectorize it. And also another profit of this approach is that we can distribute the I loop among these three statements. This one, this for this K loop, and the last one. And it also further enhances the vectorization, because here we can vectorize only over the loop I, but here we have three loops I, so we can vectorize each of these statements separately. Okay, this is the last slide of my presentation. We determine which variable is good for scalar expansion by dependence graph. Here you have two examples. So the first example is a simple for loop where we switch two elements using the temporary variable. And here the scalar expansion is used, so the temporary variable is actually an array, and we store the values using an array. And what it says here, we can reuse the memory locations. The reuse of memory locations can be eliminated by scalar expansion. Such edges are called detectable. So for this first picture, we have this picture. Nodes are the statements as written here, and the edges are data dependencies. The symbols basically are telling us which type of data dependency it is. I will not go any further into that. Basically, here it says it's forward data dependence or backward data dependence, as I said earlier. And so we have these detectable edges, and from this graph we can see that we can remove this edge and these two edges, because they reuse the memory location in statement 3 and statement 1. And from this graph we can see the resulting scalar expansion, which results in using temporary variable as an array. So thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, you can ask. Okay, so it is meant as a simple multiplication. So should I conclude it?
No, not now. But probably if you want to modify this talk, or next time when you are going to give this talk, take it into account.
Okay.
That's my advice.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, that's all. Okay, you've got.
Thank you.